From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Former Presidents Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter say President Clinton should be censured and not removed from office as the impeachment process moves to the Senate. NPR's Barbara Bradley has more.
In an op-ed piece in the New York Times, the former president said the Senate has the flexibility to avoid a trial and instead censure President Clinton. Mr. Clinton has already suffered, quote, profound disgrace, they said, and he should not be removed from office. The two presidents recommended that any censure should compel Mr. Clinton to admit wrongdoing, including a public acknowledgment that he did not tell the truth under oath. However, they also suggested that the admission could not be used in a future trial after Mr. Clinton leaves office. Many believe a trial, even a brief one, is inevitable. Several senators, including Majority Leader Trent Lott, have said it is their constitutional duty to see this proceeding through in the way the Founding Fathers envisioned. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Washington.
The world's first known surviving octuplets are in critical condition today, but doctors are hopeful that all eight babies will survive. Dr. Patty Saverick is their pediatrician at Texas Children's Hospital.
The first baby is now 13 days old, and she has done actually very nicely and remarkably well, is on feedings now, working up to full feedings, and is off the ventilator and on a small amount of supplemental oxygen, but doing very nicely. The other babies still have that rocky week, first week to 2 weeks in front of them.
Saverick says the survival rate for babies born 10 to 12 weeks prematurely is about 85%. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is expected to agree to dissolve his government today after his party said it would call for early elections. Supporters of the Y River peace deal accuse Netanyahu of dragging his feet on West Bank troop pullbacks, but opponents are angry that he has agreed to some of the accord's terms. Mission controllers have lost contact with a spacecraft that's supposed to rendezvous with an asteroid early next year. NPR's Joe Palka has that story.
The Near-Earth Asteroid Rendezvous, or NEAR, spacecraft was launched 3 years ago. Its primary mission is to go into orbit around the asteroid Eros. As a first step in achieving that orbit, NEAR was supposed to fire its main engine over the weekend. But within seconds of the time the rocket was supposed to fire, ground controllers lost contact with the spacecraft. They regained the spacecraft's signal 40 minutes later and were able to determine that the main engines had not fired as expected, but now they've lost contact again. If they can figure out what's wrong and get the rocket to fire in the next day and a half, a January rendezvous is still possible. If it takes longer to regain control of the spacecraft, the mission will be delayed, but the rendezvous can still occur. Joe Palka, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 167 points in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite is up 47. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, Wall Street appears to be unshaken by the impeachment of President Clinton. Investors are turning their attention to corporate earnings and the likelihood that the Federal Reserve will not change interest rate at tomorrow's policy meeting. NPR's Corey Flintoff joins us now with the latest.
The Dow has gained about 1.8%, shrugging off President Clinton's political difficulties. The gain was led by Amgen, the world's biggest biotechnology company, which just won the right to a new anemia drug in an arbitration fight with Johnson & Johnson. Investors also went after internet stocks after an analyst for Morgan Stanley, Dean Witter & Company, noted that the computer network now has some 80 million users. Among the stocks listed as good buys were America Online, Yahoo, and Amazon.com. The Nasdaq, where many technology stocks are traded, gained more than 1.5% to climb into record territory. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Hewlett-Packard has announced that it's cutting prices on all of its personal computers and notebook computers by up to 20%. The company says the price cuts take effect immediately. Motorola is expected to announce an agreement to buy the consumer wireless phone operations of Lucent Technologies. Both companies have confirmed the deal but are not disclosing the terms, but analysts estimate the value at between $100 million and $200 million. Levitt's Furniture plans to close 27 of its 90 stores as it tries to downsize to reduce its reduced profits. The International Monetary Fund says fears of a global economic meltdown have eased, but risks remain, weighted on the downside as we enter the new year. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 200 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A bunch of new movies are opening for the holidays. On today's Fresh Air, our film critic John Powers joins us to talk about the best and worst of them. One of the movies that is already open for the holidays is Waking Ned Divine. We'll hear from Kirk Jones, who wrote and directed the comedy, and David Kelly, who stars in it. Also, TV critic David Bianculli takes a look at the mid-season lineup, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new Burt Bacharach box set. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Most of us have 2 3-day weekends coming up. You might spend some of that time at the movies, so we asked our film critic John Powers to join us and tell us about the new ones opening for the holidays.
Well, I think, you know, the most awaited film in some sense is Thin Red Line, which is a World War II film about Guadalcanal made by Terrence Malick, who's sort of a Hollywood legend. He made 2 films 20 years ago, Badlands and Days of Heaven, and then basically dropped out. And, you know, as often happens when you leave something, your legend only increases. So this is his first film in 20 years, and everybody's been really curious to see it for all sorts of reasons, not least because it seems to be some sort of bookend to Saving Private Ryan.
Is it good?
I don't know, in all honesty. It's extremely strange. It's based on a James Jones novel about a company fighting at Guadalcanal. And the novel by Jones is very, very down-to-earth and prosaic and dirty and grubby. It's perhaps the most realistic account of fighting and the psychology of fighting that, you know, that I've ever read. What Malick has done with this story is to turn it into sort of a metaphysical drama. So it's a kind of Zen war movie, if that makes any sense. You know, whereas Steven Spielberg in Saving Private Ryan basically sort of mythologized the Normandy landing and the people who landed at Normandy. What Malick does is he uses this war film as a sort of way of making a meditation on the nature of life, darkness versus light and all the rest. And, you know, so it's a very strange, kind of undramatic film filled with very powerful negative battle sequences and lots of complicated psychology and lots of interior monologues by lots of different characters, all of whom are sort of reflecting on the meaning of life. I mean, It's one of those films that I'll actually want to see again before I actually know whether it's good. At the moment, I was simultaneously impressed and kind of put off because it's not very emotionally engaging, and yet it's, you know, in some ways, extraordinary piece of filmmaking.
How is the cast?
Well, the cast is, you know, sort of lavishly famous. Early on, you see John Travolta and Nick Nolte, and you have Sean Penn, you have John Cusack. It seems like wherever you turn, some familiar face is doing a cameo as a member of C Company or Charlie Company, which is what you're following in the film. Certain people are particularly good. I think Nick Nolte as a kind of overly aggressive military leader. It gives a really wonderful performance. I mean, he's actually had a very good year. He's got another film coming out called Affliction, where I think he gives a really brilliant performance. So he's particularly good, and actually Sean Penn gives quite a restrained performance. But what's interesting to me in this film is that in transforming Jones's novel, Malick has to find some sort of figure who's his figure. Because in the Jones novel, there's a character played in the film by Adrian Brody, who's the kind of writer's alter ego. That character has been basically written out of the Malick film. But there's another character who's sort of a coal miner, AWOL guy, who's been pumped up in the Malick film, and he's kind of the Zen consciousness of the film. And it's clear that Malick has invented this character who somehow represents his consciousness. And so you, in the same kind of way that in Saving Private Ryan, the coward is sort of the Spielberg figure, in this film, the kind of Zen master, heroic guy is the Malick figure.
Now, we should mention that Thin Red Line is really only opening in New York and Los Angeles for the holiday season for Academy Award qualification, and the rest of us will have to wait to see it in the new year. What's opening nationally on Christmas Day?
Okay, I think the big national opening on Christmas Day is a film called Stepmom, starring Susan Sarandon and Julia Roberts, which is, you know, being much buzzed about in Hollywood. There's lots of talk of Oscars. It's being presented as this huge prestige film. And basically, it's a story about Susan Sarandon is a wife, an ex-wife in her 40s, and Julia Roberts plays the girlfriend of her ex-husband. And the question is, how are they going to negotiate dealing with the kids? And so it's basically about their sort of rivalry, which then turns into a kind of respect and friendship over time.
How is it?
Well, in all honesty, I don't think it's very good. Out here, they're acting as though this is a very classy, serious, dramatic film. But it's very much in the sort of terms of endearment and one true thing vein. It's actually another film where the great dramatic resolution is provided by somebody getting cancer. I mean, it's actually kind of funny because if you go to see the trailers of Stepmom, you would think you're going to see a kind of cheerful romp, because what they don't tell you in the trailer is that about halfway through, the Sarandon character gets cancer. I mean, you know, the joke I keep making is that the title of the film should probably be called You've Got Cancer, because it's, you know, they're trying to keep it cheerful and upbeat, yet really it's not a cheerful and upbeat film.
Well, there's another illness movie opening for the holidays. I think it's opening for the holidays. Patch Adams with Robin Williams as a doctor who's a sensitive man of conscience who heals us with his humor.
Yeah. I keep trying to get myself to be willing to go, but I have skipped this film a lot of times in the screenings. You know, I like Robin Williams, but this is the kind of role I think I don't really want to have him play anymore. Where basically he is the heroic healing figure, and everything he does is funny and heroic and charming. You know, so there are lots of shots, you can see this even in the trailer, which is one reason why I'm so reluctant to see the film, of basically him cutting up, and then you see a reaction shot, you know, by some old person in their hospital bed or a young bald child with cancer applauding and laughing merrily at Robin's antics. And there is, as you can tell once again from the trailer, the evil doctor who doesn't want to have doctors and patients exist on the same human level. And then, of course, you know, the Robin Williams character triumphs. It's really, I find it kind of discouraging because Williams is an extraordinarily talented person, yet he somehow is getting himself too often into this particular kind of sentimental heroic role that, you know, that I frankly don't want to see.
I'll tell you, I've thought often while watching these coming attractions what it would be like to be stuck in bed in a hospital and have a doctor coming in with, you know, a banana nose and a balloon nose and just like one bad sight gag after another. I think it would just be appalling.
Yes, well, what's funny is that, you know, in person, you know, Robin Williams is a very shy, charming, intelligent person who is sort of effortlessly funny, but not in the way that they're showing in the film, so far as I can tell.
Yeah, the patient's sweating a fever and the doctor has flop sweat because his jokes are so bad.
Yeah.
So that's opening for Christmas?
That's opening wide for Christmas. And, you know, to be fair to the film, since I'm essentially reviewing the trailer, you know, that it has tested very well for the company and a lot of people seem to like it.
Now, what about A Civil Action? I think that one's opening for Christmas too.
Yeah, A Civil Action is only opening in New York and L.A. On Christmas Day. You know, it's a story of a very familiar sort of Oscar-grabbing kind. John Travolta plays a personal injury attorney who more or less is cynical and greedy and preening and all those things. And then he gets involved in the case in a town where a bunch of kids have gotten leukemia and various diseases because of something befouling their water. So he takes on a suit for these families in this small town, and over the course of the film becomes more obsessed and ennobled by his desire to help them. What's interesting to me in the film is that it was directed in the directorial debut by Steven Zaillian, who wrote Schindler's List for Steven Spielberg. And it's essentially the same story, where you start off with the selfish guy who then is sort of redeemed by helping other people.
So you didn't like it very much?
No, no. It's you know, it's not a terrible film. It's just it's a very familiar kind of film.
Mm-hmm.
John Travolta is sort of his performance is sort of up and down in the film. He's I think he's often not as his best when he's supposed to be playing overly sharp people. I mean, I felt some of the same things here that I felt in watching Primary Colors, was that he has many, many virtues, but I think one of them is not really being able to sort of convey razor-keen intelligence. You know, I mean, I don't know whether he's personally intelligent, but I think somehow he's better at sort of a more emotionally expansive kind of role. And he just doesn't strike me as my image of a legal sharpie. If I think back to the Richard Gere film, Primal Fear, you actually could believe that Richard Gere was a smart, cold, calculating attorney. And you don't quite feel that about Travolta. So his performance is sort of up and down. And, you know, one final thing, I just want to mention this, a particular hobby horse of mine, is Hollywood has got to stop doing one particular thing, Terry, which is sticking in useless and annoying cameos into their films. So at the end of a civil action, the final scene is more or less in a courtroom. And I'm not giving anything away to say that because it's a court film. In a courtroom. And then, but basically at the last 3 minutes of the film, a new judge appears, and it's Kathy Bates. And she's never been in the film to this point. And what happens is you're at the climax of the film, and everybody's saying, is that Kathy Bates? The same thing had happened in Beloved when in the climactic scene when more or less the Oprah Winfrey character is reaching her great moment of truth, and the character of Beloved vanishes, all because of the appearance of a decent liberal white man. The problem is the decent liberal white man is played by Jason Robards. And this is the climax of the film. And when I saw the screening, virtually everyone in the theater turned to the person next to them and said, is that Jason Robards?
I had that experience in the middle of Saving Private Ryan when all of a sudden I started saying, wait, it's what's-his-name from Cheers.
Yes, no, that's precisely the problem. For some reason, and you even have a bit of that in Thin Red Line as well, because there's so many people in the cast. You know, so suddenly you've gone all through this film, and then at the very end, the new company commander arrives, and it's George Clooney.
My guest is film critic John Powers. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Fresh Air film critic John Powers. We're talking about new movies opening for the holidays. There's a few big animated films for the holidays, Prince of Egypt, A Bug's Life. I think Ants is still in theaters. The Babe sequel. Any of those that you recommend?
Well, actually, easily the best of the bunch is Babe.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, one of the sad things is that at this point, Babe has been declared a flop, because it got crunched at the box office by A Bug's Life. And, you know, various heads have rolled at Universal and all sorts of things. But of those four films, the most inventive, magical, best-directed and best-made film is clearly Babe, which is a slightly darker sequel to the original Babe, which was a very light and charming film. This film is kind of probably more fairy tale-like and more Dickensian. It has slightly more haunting images. You know, people, I think, are worried about taking their kids to it, although I think there's nothing half as traumatic in Babe, the sequel, as there is in, say, Bambi. I mean, that was the first film I ever saw. And I mean, even now, you know, I shudder at the thought of Bambi's mother getting killed, whereas there's nothing in Babe that's like that. As for the others, you know, A Bug's Life's sort of very entertaining corporate film. I mean, you can, you know, each new character that's introduced, you can sort of think, oh, well, I can see how they're going to market that one. You know, it's like a very skillful collection of on-screen action figures. And then there's Prince of Egypt, which is some sort of labor of love for DreamWorks and contains two genuinely remarkable sequences in its depiction of the life of, I guess, the young Moses. You know, there are two scenes that are absolutely extraordinary. There's a dream sequence that will knock your eyes out, and there's a scene where all the firstborn of Egypt are being killed that's really kind of haunting and eerie. But as for the rest, It's simply it's boring and kind of preachy, and contains some of the worst music I've ever heard. I left the theater talking to friends, and we were all thinking, like, you know, back in the old days, Disney films had great songs. You know, the Disney films, you know, Disney, you know, you know, Disney films were had such good songs that people like Miles Davis would play them. You know, now the songs are so rotten that you leave a movie that's filled with songs and you can't think of a single line of from the songs or a single melodic bit from the songs. There, you know, it's a Hans Zimmer score, and it's as undistinguished a piece of, you know, musical writing as I've ever heard.
So they don't sing the Ten Commandments of love in it, huh?
Well, no. What's curious is that because it's a slightly a more upbeat film than that, you know, Moses never really gets to the point where he delivers the Ten Commandments, which I think might kind of bum people out, you know, because it's like there Moses, the prince of Egypt, who's liberating his people, is also telling them all sorts of stuff they can't do. You know, so you don't get to that point. You just get to the point where he basically leads his people to freedom, and then the film stops.
Any other holiday movies you want to talk about?
Well, there are a couple films that aren't opening nationwide, but that do deserve mention just because I think they will make their way into lots of, you know, 10 best lists and receive lots of awards. Neither of them are very large films, but I think that they're actually very good and interesting films. The first is called Hillary and Jackie, which is the story about the relationship between two sisters. One of them is Jacqueline Dupré, who's the famous cellist, the English cellist, who got MS and then died of complications from that at a very young age. She was kind of a great cult figure in England. And the story is about her relationship with her sister, Hillary, who, in fact, when they were young, was the more talented one of the two, and then gradually watched her sister sort of skyrocket into genius while she didn't get any better. But in contrast, she married happily and had a sort of happy home life, whereas her genius sister was miserable, unhappy, and basically her, you know, she sort of felt crucified on her cello. And it's about the weird interaction between the incredibly warm and attentive sister who's not a genius and the very demanding and crazy-making sister who is the genius. It's beautifully acted by two actresses that people will have seen before. Jackie Dupré, the crazier one, is played by Emily Watson, who is in Breaking the Waves, and she gives another great performance here. Hillary is played by Rachel Griffiths, who a lot of you will remember if you saw Muriel's Wedding. She was the person who played Muriel's zany friend. She's a really wonderful actress, and she in a way has the more difficult role because she's the person who has to bottle everything up and sort of show all her feelings through a kind of veneer of decency and niceness. It's a very good film, and one of the handful of films this year, I think, that really lets actresses shine. The other film that I think that I like is the Paul Schrader adaptation of Russell Banks' novel Affliction. What I particularly like in it, and I will probably talk about this film on a later show, but what I particularly like about this film is the performance by Nick Nolte as this kind of lost cop who—he's this kind of a big man who's melting down. You know, his marriage is collapsing. He realizes that he's sort of a flunky for the big boss in town. He's got a terrible toothache, which is sort of the metaphor for his whole life. And it's, I think, a genuinely brilliant performance by Nolte, who's one of the best screen actors we have. This may be the best performance he ever gave. I think it's the best performance by a male that I saw this year.
John Powers is Fresh Air's film critic and film critic for Vogue. He'll be back with his 10 best list on Thursday. At the start of this TV season, our critic David Bianculli surveyed the field of new series and found no absolute standout. He did, however, identify 5 new series as promising. Now that we're nearing mid-season, David checks in to see whether any of those shows are fulfilling their early promise.
Based on the pilot episodes of this year's new fall series, I gave 5 shows good enough marks to recommend them. Leading the pack was Felicity, the WB Network's drama series starring Kerry Russell as a college freshman. Then there were 2 somewhat silly hour-long comedy dramas, Buddy Farrow and Fantasy Island, and, finally, 2 new sitcoms, That 70s Show and Sports Night. Well, here's what's happened since then. Felicity, like many college freshmen, has gotten mopey, self-absorbed, and visibly tired. It's in a rut, and it better start climbing out soon. Buddy Farrow on CBS, with Dennis Farina as a throwback detective from the Rat Pack era reopening his business in the 90s, started strong but never slipped into a second gear. ABC's remake of Fantasy Island with Malcolm McDowell, I kept watching and enjoying, but I think I was the only one. Even though there are a few more episodes to run, ABC has already canceled it. That leaves the two sitcoms. The Fox period comedy, That 70s Show, has remained fresh and clever and developed into a show where every single character is likable, identifiable, and very, very funny. And finally, there's ABC's Sports Night, which has turned into the best new show from the first half of the season. And if you didn't jump aboard the Sports Night train at the start of the season, you get another chance Tuesday night as ABC repeats the original premiere. The action takes place at the Continental Sports Channel, a thinly veiled version of ESPN. Peter Krause and Josh Charles star as Casey and Dan, the star anchors of the network's Sports Night wrap-up show. Behind them, and behind the scenes, are Felicity Huffman, Joshua Molina, and Sabrina Lloyd as producers and assistants, and Robert Guillaume, formerly of Benson, as the boss. The series comes from Aaron Sorkin, who wrote A Few Good Men, and he's brought a feature film sensibility to Sports Night. For one thing, it's as much a drama as it is a comedy. For another, the characters are deep and surprising, and often very flawed. For a third, the behind-the-scenes TV talk and TV battles are right on the money. Here's a scene from a rundown meeting in which a network representative objects to a lengthy feature in that night's storyline.
I have some concerns about segment 23.
Is this you or the network?
In these meetings, Casey, mine is the voice of the network.
Wow, JJ.
What are your concerns?
Who is Antezaki Nelson, and why are you doing a 3-minute and 20-second feature on him?
Natalie!
Antezaki Nelson's a South African distance runner, 15,000 meters. As a schoolteacher in Jamestown, he led protests against the white majority.
That's swell, but folks, I have...
He was beaten up and thrown in jail. His legs were broken, and the doctor said he'd never walk without a cane. He's 41 years old, and guess what he's doing tonight?
It doesn't matter, because I've already changed the channel.
He's running in the World Pacific Games, an event this network is carrying live tonight at 9. The Antezaki Nelson features promoting...
Look, I am all for you guys spotlighting our other programming, but can't we find a good-looking 22-year-old American who might actually win?
Well, if you find him, send him over to my place, but in the meantime...
Look, I have a ratings book on my desk that's very instructive. Now, it says that our key demographics, including 11 to 17-year-olds who watch your morning rerun over breakfast, do not want to see features about 41-year-old, politically oppressed, third-world distance runners. Now, they are instructing us, and I think it's a good idea to listen.
I've got Jason Grissom on the phone. JJ, Danny and I have hosted shows in the fifth and third largest markets in the country, and we've received awards for journalistic excellence. I'd prefer not to take my instructions from 11-year-olds. And the next time you sit in our rundown meeting and I hear the voice of the network come out of your mouth, I'm going to put my foot on your throat.
Since the season began, these characters have bonded, fought, blossomed, and grown. And there have been serious issues tackled, too. Sexual assaults by athletes, drug use by TV personalities, and the whole tricky dance between professional sports organizations and a network trying to cover them. Sports Night is sharply written, very nicely acted, and almost always contains a genuine surprise or two. In my book, that's a promise delivered. If you haven't started watching it yet, now's the time.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Travelocity.com. Online reservations with more than 400 airlines, 40,000 hotels, and 50 car rental companies worldwide. www.travelocity.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews the new Burt Bacharach box set. Also, Waking Ned Divine. We'll hear from Kirk Jones, who wrote and directed the new film comedy, and David Kelly, who stars in it.
The moment I wake up, before I put on my makeup, I say a little prayer for you. Walk home in my hair now, and wondering what dress to wear now, I say a little prayer for you.
Together, that's how it must be to live with that deal. work, I just take time. And all through my coffee, every time I say a little prayer for you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Songwriter Burt Bacharach wrote most of his major hits in the 1960s, but these days he's everywhere, in magazines and newspapers, on stage with Elvis Costello, and in record stores where CDs covering his old tunes abound. Critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new compilation of Bacharach hits and misses. Kevin says you have to respect anyone who wrote Alfie, Walk On By, Make It Easy On Yourself, anyone who had a heart, and What's New Pussycat?
The telephone call that tied up the line for hours and hours. The Saturday dance, I got up the nerve to send you some flowers. Magic moments, memories we've been sharing. Magic moments, when two hearts are caring.
Harry Como and the Ray Charles Singers, 1958, with an early hit for composer Burt Bacharach and lyricist Hal David. Already, Bacharach had a flair for odd instrumentation. Another arranger might use whistling or comic bassoon, but not both. For Bacharach, the song and the arrangement unite to create a vivid mood or effect. Bacharach thrived in opposition, writing dozens of cleverly arranged hits that bucked the trend toward rock and guitars. His signature became defiantly mellow brass. Solo or harmonized, muted or open, those horns rarely worked up a sweat. They seemed to speak more than sing a melody. From the peppiest song ever about failure, Do You Know the Way to San Jose. When folks talk of Burt Bacharach, they often mean three people. Him, lyricist Hal David, and singer Dionne Warwick, who joined them in 1962. Hal David's best lyrics betrayed a dark realism about sexual politics and were part of any 60s kid's worldly education. Dionne Warwick started out singing demos for them, but from the first, she was their best interpreter. Bacharach's melodies are minefields of wide leaps, shifting time signatures, and surprise key changes. Warwick made them sound almost easy and gave the lyrics the right twinge of melancholy. Other singers doing Bacharach copied her, but even when another singer got first crack at a tune, she'd make it her own. Here's Dionne Warwick on a song introduced in the show Promises, Promises by future TV gumshoe Jerry Orbach.
What do you get when you kiss a guy? Don't you?
Backrack the arranger wallowed in the drecky cliches of adult contemporary music. Cocktail piano or two pianos, swelling strings, Brazilian rhythms, and those Tijuana-style brass were recurring motifs. Hollywood began using Bacharach and David to signify sophistication, meaning sex. Their song Wives and Lovers was notoriously sexist, but they made up for it with this acid portrait of a pickup artist who grabs a girl's attention and then pours on the honey talk.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa. Pussycat, I've got flowers and lots of hours to spend with you. So go and powder your cute little pussycat nose. Pussycat, I love you. Yes, I do. You and your pussycat nose. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa.
If Dionne Warwick makes tricky lines sound like anyone can sing them, Tom Jones makes What's New Pussycat sound like only Tom Jones could sing it. He's so good you could miss the arrangement with its pileup of polka band, girl group, and harpsichord, and that bizarre moment when Breaking Glass cuts off the intro. Sometimes, Bacharach sounds weirdly like spaghetti western genius Ennio Morricone, for a few seconds at least. All this is from Rhino Records' 3-CD, 75-tune Burt Bacharach anthology, The Look of Love, which could be what you want for Christmas. It's got the inevitable hits by Dusty Springfield, The Carpenters, and B.J. Thomas, and lots of Dionne Warwick. There are obscure singles that mysteriously didn't click for the likes of Trini Lopez and Warwick's male counterpart, the ripe-for-rediscovery Lou Johnson. Also included are a couple of duds that mysteriously were hits, This Guy's in Love with You, and One Less Bell to Answer. There's mercifully little of Burt's own feeble singing, and the box largely skips his 70s decline after he and Hal David and Dionne Warwick parted ways. But Bacharach never went away for long. A collection spanning Perry Como, That's What Friends Are For, and Elvis Costello says a lot about longevity.
That song is so. The light that I'd bless. She took my last chance of happiness. So God give me strength.
Nowadays, downtown New York hipsters as well as Elvis Costello do Bacharach tunes. Over the years, jazz musicians like Stan Getz and McCoy Tyner have devoted whole albums to them. But few of these tributes are much good, and Burt's songs never became jazz standards. Partly that's because with him, as with Duke Ellington, the original arrangement beats most remakes. Some folks portray Bacharach as ambassador of bachelor pad music or even radical Jewish culture. But I think the real reason he's back is simply our belated recognition that these songs burrow deep under our collective skin. Bacharach and David aren't Rodgers and Hart, or Harold Arlen and Johnny Mercer, but they're worthy successors to songwriters like that. On that score, in our time, they stand alone.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of New Dutch Swing. Burt Bacharach and Elvis Costello will join us on Wednesday to talk about their collaboration. Coming up, Waking Ned Devine, we meet the star and the director-writer of the new film comedy. This is Fresh Air. The new movie Waking Ned Devine is about what happens to two older men in a small coastal village in Ireland who've been best friends for life when a freak financial windfall alters the landscape.
Michael O'Sullivan, are you a millionaire?
Well, Jackie, would I spend my time sitting on this old beach if I was a millionaire?
And I believe you would.
Are you going in for a dip?
More important things to do. Now look and see what I found in the small print of the Irish Times last night. Look at it. The front page, down at the bottom, winking at you. Lotto results. Winner from County Morwes.
A local winner. God, that's a thing.
Jeffers, Michael, it's more than local. County Morwes is big, but there's only one village in it.
Tullymore.
Tullymore.
Is this a fact, Jackie? A winner in the village?
In Tullymore itself, yes.
And, how many are living there now?
Well, there's 52 precisely, Michael. You've not won, I've not won, and Annie's not won. That leaves a total of 49.
And one is the winner. Has the news reached Tullymore?
Nobody's figured it out yet. So nobody knows but the winner.
As it turns out, the lottery winner is a man named Ned Devine. Michael and Jackie track him down. They find him dead of a heart attack in front of the TV with the winning ticket still in his hand. Apparently, the shock of winning was too much for him. When a lottery official comes to town to give Ned the check, Jackie and Michael hastily cook up a scheme where Michael impersonates Ned and receives the winnings. Michael and Jackie have to convince the rest of Tullymore to play along and share in the winnings. Fresh Air's Barbara Bogave spoke with David Kelly, who plays Michael O'Sullivan, and Kirk Jones, who wrote and directed the film. She first asked Kirk Jones how he came up with the idea for the movie.
The whole idea for the film really started with a newspaper clipping that I read in an English newspaper, which said that in a tiny little village in the middle of nowhere, a postmistress had put a sign in her window which said, "No, I have not won the lottery." And the story was that the local community was beginning to suspect her of having won some money. She said she hadn't won anything, and they said she was so tight-fisted that even if she had won, she'd never tell anyone anyway. And I was just really intrigued by this idea of a huge lottery winner hidden within in a small community. And that really sparked the idea for the whole film.
I imagine you, or maybe all of you there on the set, became somewhat connoisseurs of lottery stories. Did you hear more lottery stories as you filmed?
I wasn't aware of too many as we were filming, but in post-production and since the film is since the film's released recently, people have been telling me stories. There was a story in a small Spanish village where a lottery winner went unnoticed and actually died and was buried. And it was a good couple of months before they realised that he was the winner. And not only was he the winner, but he had the winning ticket in his best suit, which he'd been buried in. So there was a huge debate within the family as to whether they should dig him up and get the ticket or leave him be. There was another story I was told of a lady who was very unfortunate. She won the lottery and went to the head offices in New York and died of a heart attack as the check was being handed over. And it's very interesting when you see life imitating art in that way.
David, had you heard some stories too?
No, not really. Either people say to you, "No, I didn't win it this week either." That's about all that's said. It's hugely popular in Ireland. And I suppose I'm about the only one who never played. My wife always played, and my daughter, but I'd never, ever played until this film. Towards the end of the film, I joined in, and I now play it fairly regularly.
Now, what happens in the film is really something that could only happen in a small village, that a whole group of people would collude to evade the law and come by the winnings of the lottery fraudulently. Kirk, did you have much experience of village life when you started?
I grew up in a small village near Bristol, and when I came to write the project, I spent a lot of time in Southern Ireland in a small village there, and used to travel from that village each day to even smaller communities. And I saw a lot of people, a lot of characters who I used to base my own characters on when I came to write the script.
So who inspired, or what was the inspiration for some of the subplots in the film? And I'm thinking there is one of a woman who couldn't marry her true love because he's a pig farmer and he just smells too bad.
The pig farmer in particular came from, I used to live in a small village near Bristol, and just up the road was a pig farm, and I used to see this guy who every day was absolutely covered in muck, but every evening I'd see him in the pub, and he was as clean as a whistle. He was beautifully dressed and very clean and tidy, but it was interesting to see that very few people stood next to him at the bar, even though he didn't smell in the evenings. The characters of Jackie and Michael, I didn't really realise too much until I'd finished the film that I suspect they were pretty heavily based on the relationship that I had with my own grandfather. And it's only now looking back at the film that I can see so many qualities that David and Ian have portrayed so beautifully that probably came from my own grandfather.
Kirk, you wrote the script and then you shopped it around Hollywood, right? And you got some reactions that gave you pause. What did Hollywood want to do with the story?
I never directly approached Hollywood, but once the script was finished, it was taken to Cannes, and we found that there was a lot of interest, both from UK companies and American companies. And one company in particular who we went quite a way down the road with asked me to rewrite the lead characters, which I refused to do. And then they said, OK, if you want to work with really mature actors, we've got a great idea. Let's rewrite it and set it in Canada, and we'll cast Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau. And that was just like the last straw for me. I mean, I really respect those guys, and I think they've done incredible work over the years. But it felt like it would suddenly become their movie. And I just the whole American thing just scared me a little bit, I have to be honest. So we kind of walked away from that as well.
Now, the real charm of Waking Ned Devine is the relationship between your character, David, of Michael and Neil, and his best friend. It's kind of a relationship I think a lot of people would identify with as only happening, or usually happening in a really small town, where you just do anything, one person would do anything for the other, and you also have lived your whole lives together, and you kind of maintain this, at least in this case, a classic childhood dynamic, where one guy is really the naughty, devilish one who always gets the more tractable and innocent friend to do his dirty work.
Yes.
Now, did you, David, have a model in your head from your own experience for the friendship between these two men?
Not really. No, I mean, it was all there on the page. I mean, the thing is beautifully, that script is beautifully honed, and it's there. And I certainly identified with the kind of 9-stone weakling, which is a couple of stone heavier than I am. And it worked terribly well. And, of course, they wouldn't have had a real childhood. You know, they would have had to work hard, helping their parents with the job of the fishing, the farming, whatever. So it would have been a pretty tough childhood. So they are, as the character says, they grew old together, but they never grew up. And now they're in a position where they can sort of enjoy a romp. And that's basically what it's about. It's about this marvelous adventure that these two aged kids are having. It's less about the money than it is about that. And, of course, about the friendship and, let's face it, the love that exists between two true mates.
I'm talking with David Kelly and Kirk Jones, and they both worked on the new film Waking Ned Devine. Kirk Jones is the writer and the director of the movie, and David Kelly is one of the stars. Let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. If you're just joining us, my guests are Kirk Jones and David Kelly. Kirk Jones wrote and directed the new film Waking Ned Devine. David Kelly is one of the stars of the movie. Kirk, you shot Waking Ned Devine on the Isle of Man, even though the setting is a small village of Tullymore in Ireland. What did the Isle of Man offer that you couldn't find in Ireland?
A number of things, actually, both creative and kind of practical. I did most of my research in Southern Ireland, and as far as I could see, that's where I was going to shoot the film. When we came down to the finance and the pre-production, it suddenly became obvious that Ireland wasn't the most financially viable place to shoot. Cost of living there is pretty expensive, and I was unable to use my unable to use my English crew if I'd have shot there, because if we'd have taken advantage of the tax breaks, I would have had to have used an Irish crew, which would have been fine creatively, but it just meant that from a practical point of view, I couldn't ask the kind of favours that I knew I could ask of my own crew. So I was asked to look at the Isle of Man, and I went up there really not sure why I was going there at all in the first place. I'd never been there before. But within about half a day, I found the most stunning locations, equally as beautiful as anything I'd found in Southern Ireland. And I also found something I'd been looking for in Southern Ireland but hadn't quite found, and that was a tiny, tiny community which photographically said, this is a tiny village completely in the middle of nowhere. And in Ireland, I'd found a lot of very charming villages, but I suspect, like a number of places around the world, small villages often grow up along quite long roads. But what I found in the Isle of Man was a tiny, tiny community, a small cluster of very charming and characterful buildings and houses. And from a practical point of view, what made it even more attractive was that the whole village was protected and listed and was owned by the government. So instead of approaching 100 people and saying, can we please shoot in your village, we just spoke to one guy at the Isle of Man Film Commission, and he said, fine, you can have the whole village.
So how did the 100 townspeople feel about that?
The townspeople that were already there were very interested in the idea of us shooting there. And I was very aware that basically the government had given us the village and not the people that lived there. I suspect a number of them lived in rented accommodation because the government basically owned the buildings. So I suggested that one evening we get everyone together, we have a drink and some sandwiches, and that I have the opportunity to talk to the villagers and say, look, you know, we're going to be here for 6 weeks, and I apologize in advance for any inconvenience and stuff. So we turned up, and it was a very frosty reception, I have to say, when I walked in. Everyone was just staring. I didn't see one person smile. I tried to crack a few jokes and just couldn't get through to them at all. And I went through the kind of logistics of what we'd be doing and when we'd be doing it, and suddenly realized that maybe the only thing that could save me and kind of warm them up a bit was if I told them the story of the film itself. And ironically, it was the story of the film which made them smile and laugh, and then they applauded at the end. And from that point onwards, everyone who lived in the village was totally committed to helping us make our film, and it was a great experience to shoot there, and they were very friendly and very helpful.
A lot of them became extras.
They did. I'd already established a technique in TV commercials for using people who were genuinely kind of charming and eccentric and with very interesting faces. And it's something I was very keen to carry through into the film. And coincidentally, a lot of the people who actually lived in the village were great, great characters. So I used those as my extras. And a couple of them had a few lines and were had very small parts in the film.
Kirk, I read that Waking Ned Devine wasn't officially competing at Cannes this year, but you drove the only print of the film down from London. You drove it yourself for a screening. This sounds a little bit like a scene from a movie. Was it high drama? Were you racing the clock to get to Cannes, fantasizing about the million-dollar offers you'd get right there at the screening?
It wasn't quite that romantic, to be honest. It was a very interesting situation because with a couple of weeks to go, we suddenly realized that we hadn't booked any flights down to the south of France. And when we checked flights out, there were only club class available, and we had so little money left in the budget by that point that it just seemed ridiculous to waste that kind of money. So my producer, who had driven down with a film the year before, Glynis Murray, she said, why don't we just drive the film down again? She said, it's really enjoyable. and it's a great drive. So we drove down very luxuriously in a very nice Cherokee Jeep with leather seats and a CD player, and had a great trip down. But by the time I got to Cannes, and especially after people were starting to talk about the film being the hit of the festival, a couple of journalists had got hold of the story of me driving down and started to romanticise it a little bit, I think. I think the worst version I got was that I'd almost stolen an old rusty van from London, driven all the way through the night to get to Cannes just in time before the competition closed and things. So basically, it was a great trip down, and I'd definitely do it again. But Cannes was quite an interesting experience, and we just seemed to have a huge amount of luck there.
How quickly did you get a response from a studio?
Within seconds of the end credits rolling on the film, there were five major studios bidding against each other for the rights to the film for America. And the bidding went on through the night. And I remember Lindsay Law, the president of Searchlight, of Fox Searchlight, telling me that he tried to buy the film until 3 o'clock in the morning and was unable to. He went to bed until five, couldn't sleep, got up at five and started pacing up and down the Croisette, and eventually purchased the film just before lunchtime. So it was a very, very exciting time. And we'd arrived in Cannes with nobody knowing who we were. And as soon as we'd had the screening and the bidding war, we then were inundated with interviews and live TV link-ups. And it was that actually was like a scene from a film, not so much the driving down in the first place.
The headline, I remember it in the paper, Bidding War for Ned. Remember the next day? Bidding War, it was called, yeah.
Yeah.
David Kelly and Kirk Jones, I want to thank you very much for joining me today. It was fun.
Thank you very much. It was a joy.
Thank you very much indeed.
Kirk Jones wrote and directed Waking Ned Devine. David Kelly stars in the film. They spoke with Fresh Air's Barbara Bogave. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Roberta Shurrock, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Kathy Wolf. Our program was directed today by Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.